We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Listeners, we are joined by an illustrious young guest who I will introduce momentarily. But first, I wanted to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Our guest is actually somehow, among his many other accomplishments, a Chessable author. His Chessable course, Youngest Grandmaster Abhimanyu Mishra, takes you behind the scenes of his thought processes in some of the critical games that earned him the title. As our guest will be discussing, he also, especially as he got stronger, started to use Chessable. Those of you who heard my interview with Grandmaster Sam Shanklin will have heard him discuss, and Abhimanyu has discussed, how he relied on Sam's D4 repertoire when he was grinding to get the GM title. But of course, there's material there for players of all levels. And if you sign up for Chessable Pro, you can get a discount on all courses and help support Perpetual Chess. So as always, if you could use the link in the description, it helps out Perpetual Chess. As for our guest, I think all of you listening are quite familiar with this young man. He's just been setting amazing record after amazing record. Most notably, of course, he was the youngest grandmaster in the world at the age of 12 years, 4 months, and 25 days. But even since then, he has been making astounding progress as a 14-year-old. He's already number 10 in the world for juniors. He's an outlier among outliers. There's no one under 17 in the top 10 aside from him. Somehow he's also an author. I really enjoyed his book, How I Became the Youngest Grandmaster in the World, which came out last year with New in Chess. It's kind of a blow-by-blow account of all the work that goes into these amazing feats. And he's accumulated so many accolades, I can't list them all. But suffice to say, I'm really excited to welcome to the program Grandmaster Abhimanyu Mishra. Welcome, Abhi.
Hi, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat with you. Just incredible progress. And the thing that strikes me, and this has struck me for a long time, as obviously a big fan of chess and someone who's sort of seen your story develop over the years, is your work ethic really stands out. And I'm a dad, Abhi. I've got two kids, and I can't get them to do much of anything, you know? But meanwhile, you're studying chess like many hours a day. You're also fulfilling academic requirements. So I'm curious, Abhi, like, what motivates you? What is it about chess that gets you to put in such hard work to have achieved all that you have so far?
Yeah, chess is an amazing game. It mirrors life in a lot of different ways. It mirrors math, decision-making, analytical skills. It helps in a lot of different fields. And other than that, I have this desire to be the best in whatever I do. So that's another factor that encourages me to push forward.
And are there days, I mean, obviously I also love chess, but nonetheless, as like an amateur, you know, decent player, there are days where I don't feel like doing it. Do you have days like that, or are you just always raring to go?
Well, yeah, of course. These days happen once in a while, but I always have some short-term target, like For example, as of now, my short-term target is to break 2,700 ELO in another year or so. I want to become...
Yeah, so you're hoping to be the youngest super GM in history, correct?
Yes. So these goals help me work throughout the day because, okay, one day means a lot in terms of chess progress.
Yeah. And I'm sure, Abhi, one thing that impresses me in reading your book is a lot of people from your generation aren't necessarily reading books as part of their chess regimen, but you seem to have a very wide range of chess interests. Yes, you read books. Obviously, you're working with an engine. You've got top coaches. But out of all these resources, Abhi, what do you do today to study chess now that you've reached the 26, 27 level, which is just astounding?
Yeah. As of now, I use many different things to train. One of the main things I do while trading is I like to look at top Grandmaster games and I try to improve. So usually there are top Grandmaster games going on. I like to look at classical games as they have the best quality of mistakes from top players. And the good thing with chess is that it's such a vast game that no matter how strong you are, you still make mistakes. And I like to look through these mistakes and try to solve these positions myself, try to compare them with what I was thinking and how I can fix these top players' mistakes. So that in my own play, I would be able to solve such situations in a better manner.
That's interesting. And what's your approach? Like, do you have the engine on when you're reviewing the games? How much time do you spend per game? I'm curious about the details.
Usually my dad has a list of these games beforehand. He's checked them, he's engine checked them all, and there he gives me some positions which I set up on the board, and I spend, like, let's say 10-15 minutes, because realistically you could also spend 3 hours, but you wouldn't be able to, in a practical game you need to be able to mirror the circumstances. Spending 3 hours over the board and finding the actual best move is not going to be helpful in the long run. I like to spend 10-15 minutes as it's very practical.
Okay, so he selects positions for you. And are they... So one thing that comes up a lot when we talk chess improvement here on the podcast is if you only solve tactical puzzles, you're kind of like... You're kind of over-optimizing for one particular thing and you're not mirroring what an actual competitive game is like. Obviously, this is not something that you don't know. So I'm curious, is it all tactical puzzles or is it just random positions that he selects?
It's just random positions where... top players have messed up. Like,
okay.
Top players, okay, it doesn't necessarily have to be 2750 plus. It's like usually any good tournament, let's say 2600 plus, 2650 plus. Just any position where they've messed up and engine thinks one player could have done better.
Okay. And from reading your book, I know that your dad is a chess enthusiast, and I was impressed with how his knowledge of the chess world obviously necessarily has expanded as your chess has skyrocketed. But how strong a player is he, or is he just relying on like shifts in the engine eval to find the positions?
Yeah, he's like a 1300 rated player, let's say like in USCF terms. But yeah, he usually uses like engines to find these positions. Like,
okay, and obviously you're putting in many hours a day. So of the hours that you study chess, like how big a component is the process you just described, Abhi?
Maybe this is around 20%.
Okay, so what else are you doing?
Other than that, I really go through all areas of the game. Like calculation is another big thing I do. I find some puzzles or the other. It's always useful to train because, okay, it'll help me see things faster and it'll help me see more complicated things. Other than that, I like to go through some endgame, polish my openings a bit, and so on.
Yeah, I was impressed in the book that you mentioned being a big fan of Endgame Magic, a recurring series by Grandmaster Carsten Müller, because my experience as someone who used to teach scholastic players is endgames often are not their favorite. Now, obviously, you're not your typical player, but I'm curious, have you always loved all aspects of the game, or was there a period in your chess development where you preferred certain parts of the game over others?
Yeah, there's times where of course, you don't necessarily love everything about the game of chess, but you have to understand that at some point you cannot avoid it. Like, just because you can't go to your opponent and tell me, don't take me to this kind of end, don't take me to an opposite color bishop ending because I haven't studied that. One day or another, you're going to have that in a classical game and you're going to have to face difficulties on the board. So, yeah, there's like, for example, early stages of my career, I used to be very opening oriented, and this this meant that, okay, later on in the game, I was having issues, like, with middle game and end game. And, of course, I needed... You can't really, like, shy away from these issues. You have to work on them more. That's the only way how to fix them.
Yeah, I enjoyed the part in the book where you mentioned one of your coaches, Grandmaster Magesh, really saying, okay, I'm going to be his endgame teacher, you know? And then you had Grandmaster Aaron, also shout out to the Kings and Queens Chess Academy in New Jersey, who helped you a lot focusing on openings. Do you still have, I'm sure you mentioned on the C Squared pod that, you know, you may not be able to reveal all of your coaches at this point, but do you still have different coaches working with you on different aspects of the game?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there are many different aspects, and okay, I don't want to share too much other than that.
Okay. Would you mind sharing, like, how often are you meeting with coaches during the course of a week?
Maybe around 2-3 classes usually. Like, not with every coach, but yeah, like, overall in a week, 2-3 classes.
Okay. And that would be so 4 hours or something in total, or?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. And so what is your, and I'm guessing, having crossed the 2600 level, your opening work is now pretty much engine and database driven?
Yeah, of course. Nowadays, you cannot... The days have gone where you can analyze without an engine. There has to be some sort of a human touch that... Many times, engine will say some position is, say, better for white. But this kind of position will be very complicated, and you have really no idea what's going on. I think another big aspect of opening preparation is making it practical. That, for example, if your opponent plays a wrong move over the board, you have some clarity of what is going on and you're able to punish them.
Mm-mm.
So you need to make sure you don't entirely rely on engine, but it's a pretty big component.
Okay. So you're working on all aspects of the game every day, doing some game review of positions selected from your dad. And I believe you said to Fabiano and Cristiano on the C-Squared pod, you're still attending school, but if I understood it correctly, it's like asynchronous, basically. It's like an online school. Is that right?
Yeah, I attended online school.
So are those classes live, or are they like you just have to make sure you do the work at some point?
They're live classes. It's not too much, like maybe a couple hours a week, but like more, it's not like anything. Like it's also another parallel front, but most of my energy goes towards chess.
Okay, but you feel like you're able to keep up with the schoolwork without. Compared to these rook endings, I'm sure. I'm sure it's not too hard. And do you or is there any aspect of like not being at a school that you miss?
Well, of course, there's that social element a little bit, but okay, it's not too great. Like not that big of an issue. I have friends online anyways, so.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess when you get out to tournaments, you get to see a lot of your colleagues as well.
Yes.
Okay. And so I feel like there's still some hours in the day, because I know you're working hard that we need to account for. So maybe you could, one thing I'm curious about is, like, do you have a structured schedule for your chess each day? Or is it more like, you know, you're going to be working on chess and you'll kind of just switch things around in order to fill that chess time?
Yeah, there's not anything structured. Like, as of now, okay, I don't really have too much of a schedule, but it's more of what's... it's also very time-based. Like, if I have a tournament coming up in, say, like 2-3 weeks, it'll be very different than, for example, when I don't really have a tournament on the horizon. Like, if I have a tournament in the near future, I will be studying opening and such things much more.
Okay, and like, for example, right now, we're recording on January 5th. Your next tournament, as far as I know, the Prague Masters in February. So probably you're not emphasizing that much yet.
Yeah, I'm not emphasizing opening that much. I'm mainly trying to improve my quality of play.
Okay, and one thing I've noticed about you, Abhi, you've got a sort of retro approach to chess, A, in your book, your enthusiasm for books that I already mentioned, but I also don't see as much emphasis on like online speed chess as someone like Nihal Sarin or Alireza Firouzja even might have showed in their teen years. Is that a conscious choice on your part?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I don't really like playing online in general. Like the time controls are very short, and the main thing for me is playing classical chess, and it's where I like to think more in general. So yeah, these online online things I play once in a while for fun, but not as I don't think they help me too much in terms of improving my strength.
Okay. And obviously, when you were coming up, as traced in your book, you played a lot, especially like, you know, you played whatever you could in addition to a hardcore studying schedule. But now that you don't want to play just any tournament, you've got like a decent sized hiatus, as we just discussed right now. Like, does it feel odd to you to not compete for 6 weeks straight or whatever it is?
Yeah, it feels a bit odd. It's also like slightly like relieving a little bit, in a sense that, okay, there's not immediate games every day.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot of training is going on, so it's not all the time is being taken up anyways.
Okay. And do you ever play training games?
Yeah, I play some online and so on. These are like maybe a couple games a day, but okay, not hundreds of Blitz games every day and so on.
Okay. And are those are just sort of like you're entering the Blitz pool, or are you like arranging games with or playing your trainers, or like who do you play?
Well, yeah, usually it's against some website, some pool, just whoever's willing to come on. Decently strong.
Gotcha. Yeah, and obviously, I know that you don't want to say too much about what your accounts are. You've got to workshop some openings, understandably. So not much Blitz, and now a very varied approach. But would you say that you have like core beliefs about what the best things to get better at chess are?
Yeah. So this is like a process to get better, or?
Yeah, like, what do you think are the most important things? Like, what, I mean, A, that got you to where you are, but even just generally.
Sure. I think this is, of course, a very difficult problem, and it varies from person to person. But I think the best approach would be to find your problem areas. This can be done, for example, by analyzing your games. Every game you play, analyzing that, finding where you went wrong, why you went wrong. Because one thing with chess is it's not luck-based.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, every mistake you make has a reason, and it's a skill issue in some form or the other. If, for example, you say, I messed up in time pressure, there's two problems with that. First of all, why did you get into time pressure? And secondly, even while being in time pressure, you should be able to see these things. Like, there's always room to improve, is my point. So finding where you're struggling the most and then working on that in a dedicated manner is one way to improve quickly.
Okay. And then you're obviously, in order to do that, you're using a wide variety of tools, as all of us are these days. And speaking of which, so we've got a question from a supporter of the pod. This is from Brian Karen. And he's also, Brian's a big chess fan and has noticed your, if I may call it, like an analog sort of approach. Obviously, you're using digital tools too. But Brian asks, he says, can GM Mishra share his insights on the comparative difficulties and advantages faced by prodigies over a century ago compared to the contemporary era? Specifically, he'd like to hear you discuss where you believe the challenges were both more formidable and more manageable, say, 100 years ago, or even if you just compare it to young Morphy, Capablanca, or Fischer. I know you know your chess history, so what do you think, Ami?
Yeah, this is a great question. Of course, technology has played a huge role. It's one of the upsides of the modern era, that nowadays everyone has access to a 3500 engine, and they can... All you have to do is just input a couple pieces and click enter, and it'll give you lines, it'll give you exact evaluation of the position, what should be done, and so on. If you think of like Fischer's era, and like he had to, if he like, I think there were stories that he messed up a rook ending or something, and he spent like months analyzing this rook ending and just becoming better at rook endings in general. Like this was frankly amazing for me. And another key difference is the access to information. Nowadays, like all the information, like it's very simple to find, for example, opening courses and everything online. Everyone has so much more access to information. While back then, I think like the top books were in Russian. So Fischer learned Russian.
Right.
This shows how much dedication he had towards the game of chess. And it's the reason why he was Fischer. I love Fischer's work ethic, and it's one of the things I try to mirror in my everyday life. Like, for example, once upon a time, I lost this double bishop ending. This was around, like, let's say 5 years ago. I was like 9 years old. And I asked my dad to find some relevant material on this topic, and there was, of course, there was, nowadays with the internet, there's always, there's like unlimited amount of, information. So there, he found this game, I believe it was between Ganguly versus Wang Hao, and it was also very good because this game was annotated by Ganguly himself, who played the game and won, and he was explaining his thoughts throughout the game. I put the game on the board, and I spent 5-6 hours, and I went through the whole game. And next time I got a double bishop ending, it made my life a lot simpler.
Huh. I love that story. And is that typical for you? Because, again, you do mention playing through a lot of games. Are you often putting it on the board, or will you often just sit there with your feet up with a book or somewhere in between, you know, using a digital interface?
Usually I put everything on the board. I'm quite old-fashioned.
Okay. And, you know, that comes up as, you know, the Perpetual Chess has a lot of adult learners who've sort of come to the conclusion that that might help with muscle memory. It might help you retain things better. Was that something that sort of was preached or suggested by your dad or a coach, or is that just a personal preference of yours?
Well, it's kind of both. But yeah, from the very early days, I've been accustomed to the board rather than a machine. And yeah, most classical games are over the board, so maybe that has some kind of impact there too.
Okay. Yeah. And again, you've got a shared love for chess books. So even when you're reading books, like I think you mentioned, I think it was to Fabiano and Christian, you mentioned recently having read Think Like a Super GM. When you go through a book like that, again, is that one, is it always on the board, always old school, or are you sometimes doing it differently?
Yeah. Like 99.9% of the times it's on the board.
Okay. And as you reach the 2630 level, is it harder? Are you reaching a point where it's harder to find books that can help you, or are you still reading just as much as you use other tools?
Yeah, books are always useful. There's always some good book or the other by renowned grandmasters. Another good thing is that these books, if I get a book of, say, like 100 positions, even if 10 of those positions make me struggle, I'll consider it a good book.
Okay.
So another reason why I pick up books from renowned grandmasters is that there are many different solutions. Like, there's one solution to a problem, but there's many different angles of looking at it. And I like to see that even if I've solved the position, how these other grandmasters are looking and approaching the same problem.
That's a great attitude. We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Abhimanyu Mishra. And we are back. So what have been some of your most formative books over the years, Abhi?
Yeah, I think like Dvoretsky's Endgame Manual was a pretty good book. I think like for the lower level, Jeremy Silliman had an Endgame book that was also quite useful growing up. Other than that, just trying to remember, there were a lot of different.
Well, before you go on, let me ask you about Dvoretsky's Endgame Manual, because it comes up fairly frequently here on the pod. You know, Hikaru, who I got to interview some years back, mentioned that he thought it was indispensable for, say, 2300 on up. But a lot of trainers recommend it for lower rated players, and they might struggle with it. So what level were you, Abhi? Obviously, again, caveat, you're not the typical chess student. But what level were you when you got your hands on that book?
I started doing the King Pot Endgame section when I was like 1700, but okay, from there, I realized how complicated it was. I started actually finishing the rest of the book around, let's say, 2300, around 2400.
Okay, so that jibes with Hikaru's recommendation. And did you go through it cover to cover, or like what was your approach to that particular book?
Yeah, I went through every single position again, set up everything on the board, and it was the time of pandemic, so...
Okay.
So I had a lot more time on my hands, and I was just making sure I did everything properly so that whenever it opened up, I would never miss an endgame win.
Amazing. And I know you've used some Chessable for your openings, but with a resource like that, with the endgame manual, like how do you make sure you actually remember the stuff that you learn?
I think one thing is like repetition might help over a long period of time. But I think this, like, one main aspect is that you're not supposed, like, well, with me, everything, whatever I do, I don't see the answer beforehand. Like, I try to solve these positions from the book, even though it's a theoretical position, for example, let's say Vancouver, I try to find the draw. Now, okay. If I'm not able to find the draw, okay, that's fine. But after then reading the solution, I'll understand the problem much better than opposed as to just seeing the solution in the first place.
So an emphasis on active learning.
Yes.
Yeah, that's, again, commendable. It seems like you were getting good advice from a young age. And do you think that you have a particular skill that stands out? Like, of course, Magnus is famous for having this amazing memory that his trainers highlighted from a very early age. Hikaru, it was his calculating and tactical prowess. Do you feel like there's one skill of yours that comes easiest to you, Abi?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I'm not. There are many different things I try to be. I try to work on like all the aspects. Maybe one thing I'm decently good at is mapping patterns from different positions.
Okay.
For example, like if I see some structure during the game, I'll try to map it to some opening ideas in a different context.
Okay. That's interesting. And to me, one thing, just as an outside observer, your work ethic stands out even compared to the prodigies I mentioned. But it's interesting for me to hear that you work very hard, you put in a ton of hours at chess, but it does seem like from what you've said in our conversation, there is some freedom within it. It's not like 2 hours on tactics, 2 hours on endgames. It's like what piques your curiosity within a given day. Is that fair to say?
Well, of course, there's always a mix of everything. Like, I don't want to just be working on endgames the whole day, because
right
after a period of time, it won't be too helpful. So, yeah, there's a mix of everything, but it's okay, not too strict.
Okay. And what's your approach with your games, Abi? Like, you mentioned in the book, I believe, reviewing them without an engine, but I'm curious, like, how much time you spend reviewing each game and how often you revisit your games?
Usually, even in the middle of tournaments, like, during the game, like, these games are broadcasted online and so on, so while I'll be playing inside my game afterwards, by the time my game is over, no matter what the result is, my dad will have prepared an analysis of the whole game.
Wow. And
so whatever mistakes I made throughout the game, I will like set them up on the board and I will try them again. This is so that I can become better for the next day.
Wow. Sorry, go ahead.
It depends on the size of the game and how many mistakes I've made. But yeah, usually it takes maybe half an hour to 1 hour. Not too bad.
Oh, that's not bad. And in the older days, like, was that typical, like, throughout the last few years of your chess development? Or was there a period where you were spending more or less time reviewing your games?
But yeah, throughout my chess development, I've been always putting emphasis on whatever mistakes I've already made, because that's one of the best indicators of where you can improve.
Okay. And then I'm guessing some of your trainers are maybe reviewing your games as well?
Yes. Yeah, they also okay. help with this decision, this process of finding out where the issues are.
And do you find it a challenge? One thing I've noticed is it can be easy to say, like, you know, to drill down on a specific mistake you make in a game, but maybe not necessarily to notice a sort of broader pattern. Do you have any advice for how to notice, like, a pattern of something that needs to be worked on in your game?
Yeah, this is also quite interesting. There's no, like, definite answer, per se. But I think it's, like, maybe, like, you have to look at the game with fresh eyes, and you'd have to kind of compare that, okay, this game, this was the mistake, this was a mistake. What is similar in this? What is different in this? How can I get, is this common or is this completely different? Like, it's not too simple. It's very simple to say this, but it's much harder to actually implement this. But I think, yeah, you have to kind of look at these games with fresh eyes and try to see. This is also where it helps having a second person.
Yeah.
Like a trainer or a teacher, a coach, anyone can help with this process, because okay, they're less biased in some sort of a way.
Yeah, I was thinking about that and bias, because in one of the interviews I saw with you, you highlighted the point that even when you win, you still made mistakes in the game, and that it's important to learn from those mistakes, not just the games that you lost. But I feel like humans have trouble with that. If you win, you tend to put a sort, at least I tend to put a sort of like halo effect over the game. And if you lose, it's like, you're a complete idiot. I'm a complete idiot. And, you know, everything I did was wrong. Do you struggle with that? And have you developed any sort of like systems, if so, to sort of counterbalance that?
Well, one thing with another thing about chess is it's a very volatile game. Like, a game can go for 6 hours. One person can be completely winning throughout. And at the last minute, they mess up and it's a draw, or they even lose the game. So this is why the result is not everything about the game. Like, the result doesn't speak to the experiences during the game. Like, entirely.
Right.
So, yeah, it's like, I tried, okay, even if I win a game, that usually makes the analysis more pleasant. But Right. Other than that, it's not too important.
The analysis of your Ivanchuk game must have been pretty pleasant.
Well, yeah, but then it's like, I had to flip the board. And another thing is, okay, if my opponents also made a mistake, what I was thinking during that moment, how to defend in their situation. That's another thing which I do, if I have time.
Oh, okay. And do you have a favorite game that you played?
I think, yeah, that Ivanchuk game was quite good. That was a very, very attacking game. I sacked a piece in the opening and started attacking through the central files, and that was a very nice miniature.
Yeah, and for listeners, you can see Abhimanyu's post-mortem analysis in a post-game interview. I'll link to that in the show description. It was a lot of fun.
Although there was another really great game I played against Levon Rodian. It was a very... He was a legend. Like, I think he was like top 10, top 15 when we played the game in US Championship. And it was a very different approach. It was a very positional game. And I squeezed him, and that was a very, very, very good game.
Yeah. Now, Abhi, I know you've had so many landmark successes that, like, from the outside looking in, it seems like it might be even hard to process. You know, but something like beating a legend like Aronian, like, do you ever just step back and think, like, you know, I was reading this guy's, you know, following his games 3 years ago, and now not only are you sitting across from him, but beating him? Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, definitely. I've grown up looking at his games, learning from his annotations on games and so on. It's like, it's a dream come true, basically.
And, you know, you're so young. I mean, I can't. When I was 14, trust me, I was not beating Aronian. Like, do you have to sort of, like, try to clamp down an urge to sort of get too excited that you did something well because there's more that you want to do? Like, I'm curious how you balance all the amazing things that you've done, whereas you still have a goal, like, to be the first, you know, to be the youngest 2700 player that has to keep you working. Like, how do you balance those things?
Of course, it was very nice on that day, but as the tournament went on, okay, I realized that just because you won that game, it doesn't mean that all the future problems are also solved. You will still have to face these problems. This goal still remains. You haven't finished. This is like a milestone. It's not like chess improvement in general is a marathon. And okay, I've realized, okay, like, winning one game doesn't fix everything.
Yeah. Amazing perspective for such a young man. So I saw on your Twitter feed back in November, you mentioned on C-Squared, it's your family runs your social media accounts, a picture of you chatting with Anish Giri. And I'm just curious, like, players like that who've been, you know, been through the ringer, they've been top young players, and now they're top players in the world. Is there any... like, particularly memorable advice you've gotten from anyone?
The best chess advice, well, it's not advice, it's like a fact that I've learned, like, throughout the years, is that, okay, every mistake you make in chess is skill related. It's not due to some external factors. Like, okay, outside it was raining, so I messed this up. there's a reason behind everything.
That's interesting. So yeah, taking responsibility for your results, definitely a good lesson to take heart, even if it's painful after some losses. And you mentioned another thing you mentioned in the book is that you were into martial arts and soccer. Obviously, at the top level, it seems like fitness has become a bigger point of emphasis for players like Magnus and Fabiano. I'm curious, are you still into martial arts and soccer, Abhi?
Unfortunately, no. Nowadays, it's like full chess in school.
Oh, wow. That makes me worry. So my kids, I mean, they're younger than you, but like days where they can't go outside for recess because it rains, there's like this pent up energy. They're just absolute lunatics. Do you ever feel that way from doing chess all day?
Well, of course I go outside. It's not like I just stay confined within this tiny room, but yeah, it's not too much.
Okay. And do you think that stuff like that matters for stamina? Or do you feel like you're young enough where you can play a long game no matter what?
It matters in the long run. Like, I mean, one thing I'm doing to help this is like I go outside for a walk every day, just for a while. Just don't do anything. It's also just a nice release. You don't have to think about anything. Just walk for a bit and then come back inside. It helps with stamina. But yeah, this is another. Stamina is a very crucial aspect of one's play.
Okay. And when you go for a walk, because you hear people like Gelfand always talks about how he likes to go for walks before his games. Even back in the day, Josh Waitzkin used to write about his pregame walks. I'm curious, though, in the information age, because like when I go for a walk, it's like I try not to, but I'll be staring at my phone the whole time or listening to a podcast. Obviously, that's kind of on brand for me. But I'm curious with you, like when you go for a walk, are you really able to like sort of unplug, or are you still like checking some chess on your phone as you walk?
Yeah, usually I don't take a phone. I just walk outside. I just immerse myself in nature for this period of time.
Good for you. That's admirable. Now, Abhi, on a separate topic, I was reviewing your social media feed, and you'd put your pinned tweet as an interview with Sabina Foyser at the St. Louis Chess Club, where you're relishing in your amazing performance at last year's U.S. Chess Championship, as you should have been. But she also asked you about sponsorship. Obviously, it's not cheap. You've got multiple trainers traveling all over the world. Do you have anyone helping defray costs outside of your family?
Unfortunately not. Like, I don't understand what more is needed. Like, there's people, like, chess players from smaller countries are getting 10 times more the support than I am. Like, I broke all the national and international records. I think it might have something to do with how chess is viewed in the US. Like, we as a nation we don't really think of chess as a sport. Like, in my experience, I've noticed that chess is used as a tool to get into Ivy League colleges. So people, they're not really willing to go to the top level and so on. So what happens is that here, like one example of this is I had this, at the age of 7, I broke this national expert record. And during this time, my parents, they applied to numerous scholarships, no matter the thing, no matter the cost. Let's say like even like $200-$300 scholarships. And everywhere I was getting rejected. And when we inquired like why this was happening, we were being told that they gave it to a player who was rated hundreds of points below me, but he was heading off into college. So they're giving it more emphasis to him.
Yeah, that's got to be frustrating for sure. And that even now that you're the age you described, it's you're still not seeing those opportunities.
And yeah, and they're telling us to apply after 10 years.
Right. And do you know, I mean, this might be more for your dad to answer, but so does he try to reach out to sort of corporations or, you know, people who've supported chess in the past?
Yeah, he's tried many different things, but unfortunately I've seen that even after, like, there are countries where players, they become IM at the age of like 15, 16, and everyone, it makes headlines and everyone is so proud of this player and so on, but here in the US, like, for example, after breaking this 20-year-old world record, like, the federal government, of course, is like, the federal government wasn't doing anything. And okay, even the state government, they reached out to us a little bit, but when we asked for support and so on, they kind of, despite like months of follow-up, they didn't really give anything.
But yeah, it's super frustrating. And like as we record this, news just came out today that Prague got another sponsor, you know, like additional funding from a billionaire and his company. Yeah, and part of it, I think, just from my perspective, there's an infrastructure already in place in India that makes it easier, I guess, but it's no excuse. Another thing I wanted to say, since you're here, is just the way your breaking of the youngest GM record was reported was extremely frustrating for me, just as a chess fan. You know, I mean, you were attempting to compete during a pandemic, and you know, then you had, like, you wrote about Nepo's tweet, basically saying that there should be more stringent requirements for when people get norms. And, you know, he didn't flag this in any of the, you know, prior attempts by other players to break it. And then all of a sudden when it happened, he did. I'm sure. Did that cast a pall over the experience at all for you, Abhi?
Yeah, it was a bit, it was frustrating for sure, because like every article after that point referenced this, by the way, that world number two thinks that this was not broken in a very, this is not like, in, like it kind of took away from my achievement a little bit.
Yeah. And that was the only way to attempt to get titles, basically,
at that point, okay, everything was closed. And I mean, my only option, the only place in the world where tournaments were happening was Hungary. So I went there, yeah. I played 70 games in 77 days, and I got the job done.
Yeah. And the book, again, well worth reading. They chronicle, in the book, how, like, you and your dad just booked a one-way flight. You're like, we're going to stay here however long it takes until we get this title. And as someone who's recently written a book, Abhi, I was really impressed with the quality of the writing, the coverage of sort of your whole chronology up to the point of earning that title. And I couldn't believe it, because again, you're 14 now, you were like 12 then. So I was curious, did you write this? Or did your dad write it? Did you tell him and he wrote it? Like, how did that? I mean, I'm impressed no matter who wrote it, but I'm just curious what the process was like.
Sure. So the main thing was that I kind of wrote it. But of course, the words and so on, they were refined by editors. Like, they weren't
right.
Like, the vocabulary of a 12-year-old is not enough for a book in general.
Right. I don't know. For you, it might be as a 12-year-old, I'm guessing it might be enough. But,
well, it's different because, okay, my vocabulary isn't, like, I'm mainly focused on chess, so I have, like, I know a lot of chess words and so on, but, like, beyond words that are used in chess books, I don't know too much.
Okay.
I would say.
You mentioned Fischer, of course, legendarily having learned at least passing knowledge of Russian in order to read Russian books. I'm guessing these days, being that you're a native English speaker, you don't have to learn it. You don't have to pick up any other languages for your chess.
Yeah, another thing is, okay, there's like translators online. Like, the world is it's a much simpler era for information.
So another thing I wanted to ask you about. So I know you have the Prague Masters coming up. I saw that you're signed. Shout out to New Jersey with the Pro Chess League. Is that correct? You're going to be playing Pro Chess League this year?
Yes.
And do you know when that starts?
I think this might. I'm not entirely sure about the dates. I think it might have been around the 30th.
Okay, so coming soon. Do you have anything on your calendar past the Prague Masters in February?
As of now, no. I've been requesting publicly for tournament invitations, and hopefully I'll get something. I believe if I get enough tournament invitations this year, I'll be able to cross 2,700.
Okay, yeah. I mean, sky's the limit as far as I can tell. And I was disappointed as a chess fan not to see you in Wycansee, which will be underway by the time people hear this. So I'm guessing that there was no opportunity presented to you there?
Yeah, we reached out to the organizers, but unfortunately, I wasn't considered.
That's really disappointing.
I played there in 2023, though. It was great. It was a great event. It was a nice experience sitting in the same room as Carlsen, Dingler, and all these other top players.
Yeah, I mean, it's an iconic tournament with so much history. So hopefully, I would love to see you. I mean, I would have loved to have seen you this year. But barring that, I would love to see you 2025 and many years beyond that. So do you guys consider playing in sort of these American weekend Swisses? I mean, some of them are pretty strong. Or are you mainly focused on invitationals at this point?
I'm mainly focused on playing invitationals. The reason for this is, if I played the, it started from when I was becoming the youngest international master in the world. I've always wanted to play higher. The reason for this was it's a choice. From that period, there are basically two ways you could have become International Masters. Either you could play Grandmaster Norm events and get your norms from there, or you could play International Master Norm events and get your norms from there. I chose to play Grandmaster Norm events. The reason for this was that in later years, the competition wouldn't change so much. The competition would kind of remain the same. For example, like I think Norm and Grandmaster Norm invitations would be like, say, 4.5, and then Grandmaster Norm would be like 6.57. So I would kind of be accustomed to the field already, and this is kind of what I'm planning to do as of now, to play higher invitational events so that I get accustomed to the top level.
Okay, even if it means you have to play less frequently.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, you know, you wouldn't have to choose. I'm just curious, and feel free to, you know, skip this, but Tata Steel, that's an obvious one where, like, you circle it on your calendar and, you know, we wish you were invited. Are there other, like, specific tournaments that you're thinking about that would be nice to get into?
Of course. Any specific tournament, but any event which has, like, 2,600 pluses, that would be a pretty good event. Just any, like, strong event that invites good players.
Yeah, that makes sense. We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Abhimanyu Mishra. And we are back. And Abhi, so you wrote in your book, you told the story of getting to go to Kasparov's Foundation. You talk about your being a big fan of GM Maurice Ashley, and obviously you've gotten to meet him in St. Louis subsequently. Have you had any sort of pinch-me moments in your career so far?
Yeah, I should mention the first time I met Kasparov, it was at the age of 9. There was this training camp in New York. It was amazing to see how full of energy he was and how much passion he had to the game of chess. He was still so passionate after all these years, after becoming world champion and so on. Like, it was amazing to see, honestly, for me. Like, even nowadays, every 6 months we have a training session, either in New York or St. Louis. And I remember, like, one of our past sessions, there was, I think it was in St. Louis, there was a TV in the left-hand corner, and there was some study on it, some, like, queen knight versus queen, and Kasparov looked at the study. Now, you could tell for the next 45 minutes, even though we were going through games and so on, that he wasn't fully... he was still calculating the study, and you could see the sense of relief after he finally solved it. Like, these stories of how dedicated he is, it's truly amazing. It's unmatchable.
Yeah, I guess that's how you get to be the GOAT. Do you have an opinion, by the way, about who the GOAT is?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question, but I think Magnus as of now is, like, one of the best players of all time.
Have you gotten to chat with Magnus at all?
I took a photo with him in Wikensee of 2023, but, like, talking to him too much, not yet.
Okay. And bringing it back to Gary, like, so you describe reviewing games, to the extent that you can reveal it, like, what was the structure of those sessions?
The structure of those sessions was that it's like interview type thing that we have to present 6 of our games from the past 6 months, 2 wins, 2 draws, 2 losses. And we explain our thoughts and what we thought, like, we explain our thoughts during the game, and he would give us information on how to become a better player and so on.
Okay, yeah. I think he's been using that formula for a while. How does it feel to sort of, like, sit with your games and decide which ones you're going to show to Kasparov?
That's actually one of the... That's always a very, very interesting experience. Like, okay, I remember even after winning, like, my game against Aronian, I'm like, okay, I'm definitely going to show this game to Kasparov.
Right, exactly. But then you've got to show him some losses, too. So what direction do you go for those? Do you just show him, like, your biggest bonehead blunders, or do you try to find the ones where, like, you played well while you lost?
I try to show games where I feel that I can learn. So, like, my biggest problem areas or the games that were the closest.
Okay. And do you feel like, you might not want to reveal this for competitive reasons, but do you feel like you have a relative weakness in your game right now that you're emphasizing?
Well, as of now, not too much.
Just okay.
Like, okay, I'm just trying to improve generally, but okay, I don't think there's too much of a specific weakness.
Okay. That's good to hear. And when you do postmortems with like the, you know, top 10 players, is there anything that stands out to you, or is it just like they're a little better at everything?
I think it's also, for example, when I was on C-Squared podcast with Fabiano, it was amazing how even after like reaching 2800, how he wants to understand the other person's point of view.
Yeah.
Like this open-mindedness, I think, is one very, very good aspect of these top players, that everyone, no matter how strong they are, they still look to improve.
Yeah, it's a great attitude. And hearing you mention Fabiano, I meant to ask you, so obviously I really enjoyed your interview on C Squared, but in discussing the sponsorship, Fabiano, of course, somewhat famously, his family relocated to Europe from New York in order to pursue chess more easily. Given the frustrating experience, and again, I echo the frustrations that your family is feeling as a chess fan. Did you have any conversations with Fabiano about, you feel free again not to answer this, did you or your family have any conversations about, like, you know, how best to sort of continue to make this path sustainable?
Yeah, this is another interesting question. Not particularly too much.
Okay. Yeah. Well, again, hopefully these issues will resolve themselves with your continued absolutely amazing success. So I think, Abhi, we've covered most of the major topics I wanted to discuss. We've gotten some recommendations for, like, us, you know, lowly club players. It sounds like your calendar is fairly TBD for the year. Your study regimen is somewhat free-flowing but hardcore. Is that a fair assessment?
Sure.
And what about, dare I ask about, like, plans when you're 18? You're obviously on a professional track in terms of chess. Like, goes without saying when you're, you know, the only sub 17-year-old in the junior top 10 by 3 years younger than everyone else. But do you envision a scenario where you might go to university, or do you think it's chess all the way?
I think there's another important aspect that, in my opinion, I believe that I'm going to hit my peak in, let's say, 2 to 3 years. And by then, okay, then I would have decided whether I want to go full-time into chess or I'm going to go into studies. The one thing I don't want is about the age of, say, 18, 20 years old, that I look back and say, if only I'd done something a little bit different, life would be much better than it is right now.
Yeah. But that's only, like, in life, we're all working with incomplete information, right?
I mean,
it sounds like you use that as a framework to make sure you work as hard as you can at chess. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, but I want to be able to do everything I can so that, okay, I don't regret it later.
Okay. And when you go, like, Prague is a beautiful historic city. Have you been there yet?
No, not yet. This is my first time going to Czech Republic.
Okay. And so you mentioned in your book, you don't tend to do much sightseeing. Now that your schedule has sort of spread out a little bit, like, are you going to build in any extra time in a trip like that?
Well, it's a quite exhausting trip. I'm not too certain, but yeah, maybe a little bit, maybe last day I'll check out some sites and so on, but not too much usually.
Yeah, and of course, as you guys mentioned in the book, like, your dad is working for the most part, like, often basically working two jobs as, like, your manager and caretaker, and, you know, needing to actually do is he a computer programmer or software manager? What's his exact?
Yeah, he's a software engineer.
Okay, yeah, I mean, like, doing that during your games and then being there for you when or doing it overnight. I mean, it's supreme sacrifice from your family as well. So Abhi, you mentioned in your book, like, you mentioned seeing this movie when you were 5, Run Milka Run. Could you tell the story of how that sort of framed your approach in your younger years?
That movie was about a very inspirational tale about a real life story about how Milkha Singh, he was an Indian runner, and it was how he trained and so on. Like, they made a whole movie about his life story, and that really inspired me to push and achieve my dreams.
And are you able to, do you watch any shows or movies these days?
I watch a little bit, but okay, not too seriously, just once in a while.
What would you watch?
Not anything chess related for sure. just like, I don't watch, I mean, other than, the one thing I like watching in terms of chess is like the C-Square podcast.
Of course, yeah.
It's run by Fabiano and Christian, and they've done an amazing job inviting guests and so on. What I most like about the show is it's not, rather than like specific positions, they talk about a variety of things surrounding chess, and it's amazing for me to get these top players' opinions on things, like their thought process in general.
Yeah, I agree. It's amazing, and they're quite frank in it, which I really appreciate. I mean, they don't hold back, and it's, you know, Christian does an amazing job hosting, and obviously, you don't get to hear someone like Fabiano, like. Often someone like that would not share their full perspective, but he's pretty forthcoming. But outside of the chess realm, Abhi, like, can you reveal any of the shows that you're watching when you do get a chance?
Sure. I'm watching like some random stuff on Netflix. Okay. Maybe a movie or two, some Indian movies and so on. Okay. Okay, it's not too
special. No, like particular favorite.
No, not really.
Okay, and what about reading? Do you do any non-chess, like leisure reading?
Well, if it's required for school, that's a different thing, but usually not too much.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, Abhi, I'm again just so impressed, obviously impressed with your chess, but also just like your comportment as a young man. It's, you know, proud to be a fellow New Jerseyan. So congratulations on your success so far, and wish you continued success in the future. While I have you here, is there anything else, any other points you'd like to highlight?
Sure. I'd like to thank everyone for the love and support throughout this journey.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, and I'll link to all your social medias so people can follow your continued progress. So good luck in Prague and the Pro Chess League, and hopefully you will have many other invites subsequent to that. Certainly deserved, and can't wait to see your continued progress, Abhi.
Thank you.
Podcast Network.